friends. During the past week, we received a letter from a pastor down in Maryland, which I must read to you. The letter is as follows. Through no fault of yours, you have lost a TV viewer, Harvey Nelson, aged 8, of Salisbury, Maryland. Harvey, though not a Catholic, attends our school, and 2 weeks ago, his house fell in on him. A priest stationed here was transferred. He asked a sister in school who it was who took his good friend away, and she gave him the simple answer, why, Harvey, the bishop changes all the priests, since you are the only bishop that he knows. You are on his blacklist. I think it's a little matter you could easily straighten out and bring a lost sheep back in the fold. I shall have him watching just the same. Harvey probably thinks that ABC means awful bishop changes. Harvey, I want you to know that I had nothing whatever to do with it, but to make up for it, I'm going to send you a Christmas gift of making a trip to that friend of yours. The subject that we announced for this evening is capital always right or is labor always right? The immediate answer is neither. After all, economic disputes are very much like domestic disputes. Are husbands always right? Are wives always right? There's only one way that I can tell which is right when they're walking, and that is the one that walks ahead is mad. Perhaps for a long period of time, one side might have been very much in the wrong, but it's possible also for another side every now and then to be in the wrong. At the present time, there are angels on both sides. But there's still a little nick in both, too. And it's very easy to talk about social justice, but one must be very careful that one does not become interested in social justice because of a failure of individual justice. It could very well be that some people go into social justice simply because they feel a wrong on the inside, so they compensate for it by trying to right everyone else's wrong. Remember, that's what David did, the great Jewish king. One day the prophet Nathan called on him and told David about a grave case of social injustice. He told him of this poor man who had one ewe lamb, and he loved it as he loved a daughter. And the rich man who lived next door, because he was making a feast for visitors, came and stole the ewe lamb. And when David heard of it, his anger rose in righteous indignation, and he said, "This shall not be. He's worthy of death." And Nathan pointed his finger at him and said, "Thou art the man." In other words, David had stolen somebody else's wife. Here he was concerned about a sheep. So when there's talk of social justice, whenever I hear anyone get very vehement about social justice and insist on this or that, there's always one question I always want to know. How much does he pay his housekeeper? And then I cannot see either why, for example, we should have chaplains for labor any more than chaplains for capital. No class is always right simply because they are classes. Seems to me that the business of a chaplain is always to defend the common good and justice. And then he can choose in a conflict which side is right and throw his weight on that side. Now we'll begin to review something of the history of labor. And believe me, labor had a hard struggle through the centuries. Well, first of all, the history. Secondly, some suggestions of a problem, and thirdly, a solution. First of all, the history. The history of labor through the centuries has passed through these stages and almost these crucifixions. First, there were slaves. Then there were serfs. Then there were servants. Then there were employees. And finally, now, there are free citizens. First of all, labor was slave in pre-Christian history. For example, in Athens, out of 200,000 free citizens, 20,000 of them alone were freemen, the rest were slaves. In Attica, that boasted of its freedom, one-fourth were freemen, three-fourths were slaves. Cicero tells us that Praetor Domitian at one time crucified one of his slaves simply because he was too anxious to shoot a wild boar. We know of Flaminius, who killed one of his slaves simply because a friend of his said he never saw a man die. Slavery was universal throughout the pre-Christian world, except in the Hebraic civilization. One never reads of a slave market there. Most people were often in slavery. Labor gradually had to work its way out of the condition of slavery, and it finally did. Through the leaven of Christianity, slaves became serfs. Now, there's a world of difference between these two. A slave is property, just like a heart, a horse, or a car. Serf is a person. And another difference was that the serf was attached to the land. And the lord of the manor, for example, could sell the land, but the serf remained. The serf paid a certain amount to his lord, and after that, he was free to work for himself and till the land which was rightfully his. And he therefore had a great deal of security. He had what was known as status. Now, there's a difference between status and contract. When we come to this stage, we get into the stage of contracts. A child in a family, for example, has status. There's no contract between a child and the mother and father, but the mother and father will care for the child. Well, the serf had that status. And as I said, considerable security. There were indeed some abuses, but on the whole, the system was rather good. But through crises in history, this feudal system was done away with, and labor became known as service. It's interesting to note how this happened. There were two or three historical events that accounted for that transition, and the first was a decline of religion and morality. Breakdown of a sense of charity towards serfs. The second reason, the Crusades. Serfs were taken off the land. And furthermore, as they fought their battles, it was discovered that the serf equaled the knight in valor and bravery. So he began to feel his independence, and rightly so. But the principal reason was the Black Death, a plague that swept over all Europe in the year 1348. Think of it. It destroyed one-third of the population of Europe. There was not a house in which there was not a death. There were some houses in which no one was left alive. This produced a tremendous dislocation, naturally, in the economic system. Serfs were now off the land. Some of them began to go into villages. And the serfs now became servants. They no longer had status as they did here on the land. Now they entered into contracts. They were not attached to one master as they were with the serfs. They were even free to choose sometimes the kind of labor that they wished. But they lacked security. Sometimes their freedom was only nominal. And when this Black Death took place in 1348, Labor that was free and became servants immediately raised prices. We have an historical record, for example, of a harvest that was done in 1347 for £3 and in 1349 for £16. In fact, wages went up so high that the British Parliament in 1349 passed a law that the former serfs could charge only the same wages as were charged before the Black Death. The law itself was ineffective. The servant condition continued, and rather unhappily, produced some peasant wars until the beginning of capitalism. And those who were once slaves and serfs and servants now became employees. Here the servant perhaps might have been with one other servant, but just had one master. The employee here was associated with many other employees. And in a great organization, the purpose of which was profit. Now when capitalism began, labor sunk as low here as it has ever been. What was the essence of capitalism in the beginning? The essence of capitalism at the beginning was individualism, which incidentally was called liberalism. Be very careful of that term liberal, because remember that every liberal is in reaction to the last form of liberalism. And individualism meant, I want no church, I want no Bible, I want no moral law, I want no state telling me what to do with my property. The right to property is absolute, and I can do with it whatever I please. That was the essence of capitalism at the beginning. Secondly, capitalism said, there must be no labor organization. And this was the argument in those days. If you, John Doe, link up with other workers, this organization makes your contract. That means you're no longer free to make a contract. And we do not want freedom of contract to be destroyed. The argument was spurious. This poor man that was standing before the owner of the plant had only the cap in his hand. He was not free to draw up a contract. When the employer had everything, the only way the poor employee could ever match the power of the capitalist was to associate with other workers in order to establish some associative power against the money power of the capitalist. Then the capitalist also said, be content with your lot. After all, remember here is Peabody G. Winterbottom. Peabody G. Winterbottom started in our railroad driving spikes in the ties, and Peabody G. Winterbottom is now the president of our railroad. And you'll be satisfied with your lot now. Maybe someday you'll be president like Winterbottom. He started at the bottom, so can you. But believe me, it's no consolation for 999 dark donkeys to die of starvation to know that the 1,000th donkey is going to be fed a carrot. And the inequalities that were shown labor at that particular time were not to be compensated for by some vague promise of promotion. And then, the way the workers were paid and treated. For example, in Wales, children between the ages of 6 and 10 were hired in the export business. In Lancashire, in one of the big cotton mills, there were 3,000 employees. 154 of the employees were 8 years of age. 1,233 were 11 years of age. And the pay was 60 cents a week. Well, in the face of these injustices and inequalities, labor insisted on a natural right, namely the right of association. And so labor began to organize. There was a law passed in England that labor could not organize. There was the Le Chartier law in France to the same effect. Labor began to organize here. Knights of Labor at one time had 1 million members. There was violence, yes, there was murder, there were injustices, which were inexcusable. There was also violence on the other side. And finally, labor and capital reached a point where now they are free citizens. And the citizens, the laborers of the United States, are the best paid in the world. That's the story. It was a hard struggle. Now a problem. I want to tell you, tonight is a spectacular. I'm using two blackboards. Here is a problem for the future. A problem that involves capital and labor. This is the problem in capital. There is a danger of a divorce in capital between ownership and management. Between those who own and those who manage. Between the stockholders and the directors. They are not the same. The stockholder is interested in returns on his investment. The management does not own the plant. In one of the largest corporations in this country, the 18 directors own only ten thousandth percent of the common stock. Therefore, it's difficult to fix responsibility. There's not much responsibility here, except to receive adequate returns. And there can be a divorce in labor. And there can be a divorce in labor between the leaders and the workers. It can happen that those who lead do not work. And those who work do not lead. These can be just as well paid as the directors of these big corporations. And they sometimes have just as much money to manage. Now that divorce, if it ever happened, would be very serious. Now, how is the problem being worked out? It's being worked out very well. It's being worked out by management and labor or workers getting together to discuss the problems that are of mutual interest one to the other. You know, one thing I would like to see, I would like to see a meeting of the labor leaders and the stockholders get together. That would be a meeting I would love to attend. And there is actually a wider interest in developing now in both capital and labor. For example, management is beginning to be interested in workers to see that they get a living wage. They're beginning to be interested, for example, in the goods that they produce, that they are of good quality. They're interested in the public, namely maintaining employment. And the workers themselves are beginning to be interested in management. They're beginning to see, too, that they have responsibility to families, and therefore the strikes must not be called without a good reason, because after all, there are mothers and children and wives that are involved in every strike. And the workers, too, are beginning to see also that constant employment is essential for our national economy. There are problems indeed, but it must be admitted The labor has come a long way, capital has come a long way, and there's developing a mutual sense of responsibility. Now, how deepen and intensify that sense of responsibility? There's actually only one way to do it, and that is through religion and morality. And here is a suggestion. Would it not be a good idea for industries to erect inside of the plants a synagogue and a Protestant and a Catholic chapel? These places of worship in the industry should not be paid for by management. They should not be paid for by labor alone either. The chaplain who is appointed should not be paid by either. He should not be the management chaplain. He should not be the labor chaplain. He should be the chaplain of both. Interested always in social justice. I think it'd do a world of good if the management would go in and kneel alongside of somebody in overalls. If they got down on their knees together, there would be less clenched fists. When the workers realized their sense of responsibility, they would attend union meetings so that the leadership would not be taken over by the communists. Furthermore, they would all discover that by eating one bread, they were one body. I hope a day will come when this will happen. We've got chapels in our prisons. Why not have chapels someplace before the prisons? Maybe if we had more of them, we wouldn't have to have them in prisons. Some years ago, someone came to me and wanted to know if I wouldn't be interested in establishing a feast for Christ the worker. And I was asked to write letters and so forth, and I refused, and I said, no. I do not believe we should ever have a feast of Christ the worker. I said, if we have a feast of Christ the worker, is he the enemy of management? Did he not die for all men? Shall we have a one-sided economic system? There's been too much one-sidedness. Instead of standing apart in justice, furthermore, it must be realized that our blessed Lord was not just a worker. If we are workers, our blessed Lord was not just a poor man. He was a rich man who became poor. He was not just a carpenter. He was the very Lord of the universe, who worked as an artisan. He did not belong to one class in contradistinction to another class. He belonged to all men in common work, and he's the only one of whom rich and poor, capital and labor can say, he is one of our own. He came from our ranks.